I'm really happy and proud that we have Janet Kolodner today with us. She's a Regents Professor of Computing and Cognitive Science at the College of Computing at the Georgia Institute of Technology. She's currently on loan to the National Science Foundation and heading up the program called Cyberlearning that many of you know quite well. It is about transforming education, but I think maybe I start a little bit more from the beginning of her academic career. She did her bachelor's degree at Brandeis University and then the master's and her PhD degree at Yale, and both in computer science. I think most of us in the learning sciences community, so we were talking about the introduction before, and I was asking Janet if it would be possible to hear also from her a little bit about her travel and own history with the learning sciences, and she agreed to speak a little bit also on that. But I mean, for us, she did two extremely important things for the learning sciences. First, she founded it at the first place. She's the founder of the International Society of the Learning Sciences, so one of the few co-founders, and she also is the founder of the Journal of the Learning Sciences. So we owe a lot to you, Janet, and we are very much looking forward to hear you speaking about one of your main works on learning by design. Well, maybe I mentioned that there is a second research focus, especially a couple of years earlier, on artificial intelligence, cognitive science, and case-based reasoning, expert-novice evolution, that was for us in Europe also highly influential, and I guess also for the rest of the world. So now I'm looking forward and give the floor to Janet Kolodner.
Hi, everybody. That was a nice introduction. Thank you, Frank. I'm sorry I'm in my kitchen. I want to start out by saying that today. We are supposed to have 7 inches of snow today, and though that's not a lot for many of you or some of you, when there's a threat of snow in Washington, D.C., as in Atlanta, where I lived for 30 years, everything closes down. So I'm in my kitchen instead of my office. Frank asked me to say a little bit about my journey into the learning sciences, so let me talk about that a little bit. I started out, as he said, in artificial intelligence. I was interested in how we could get the computer to learn from its experiences and to use its experiences to solve new problems. Expert systems at the time had everything built into them. They didn't learn anything from experience. And that seemed to be not exactly the way that experts do it, I mean, to put it a little mildly. Experts learn from their experience. That's part of what makes them experts. And we were interested in how to make that happen. So out of that came the approach to intelligent systems, expert systems, called case-based reasoning. And somewhere along the way, several things happened. My kids were coming home from school and telling me about how awful science was. And they were in elementary school, so science should have been fun. They were confused about that because, of course, whenever we did anything with science or math at home, it was a lot of fun. Another thing that was happening was that I was feeling like I was learning a lot about human learning from building all my systems that could reason from experience. They were inspired by people. There was not a lot of research back then. There was very little that we knew about learning from experience back then. But my systems were inspired by people. We had built a lot of case-based reasoning systems. We built systems that could plan meals, and we built systems that could integrate tasks with each other and could do mediation and could do design of a couple different kinds and problem solving. And it just seemed like there was a lot that we knew about how people might learn from experience, might reuse their experiences. And I had this idea that maybe I could, a very arrogant idea, I suppose, at the time, but I had this idea that I could help inform education in some way. My kids were complaining, and I thought I could help inform education through my research. Roger Schenck called on me, asked me to be the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Learning Sciences. We didn't know back then that it was actually going to be an education journal. We only knew that cognitive scientists, when they looked at learning, they were looking, it just seemed they were looking too narrow. And then there were science education and math education people out there who also felt like their fields were looking too narrowly. And there were people in some other fields who felt like their fields were looking too narrow, educational psychology, who felt like their fields were looking too narrowly. So we needed some place to publish articles about learning in the real world. And that's what Journal of the Learning Sciences was going to be, but it was going to be combination of artificial intelligence articles and education articles and some other things, and it turned into an education journal, and also, by the way, gave me my education in education. So I don't know. Do you want me to say anything else about where I come from? Okay. So what I want to do is to start my talk. I sent you about 80 slides, and I know that's overwhelming, and that's not because I expect to present 80 slides. It's because I thought that there were a lot of different things that might come up today that you'd be interested in, and I brought slides. Thank you for the smiley faces. And I brought slides to be able to go into some of those things. So learning by design, as those of you who read the articles or have heard know, is an approach that I created to help middle schoolers learn science through design activities. It's interesting, there are a lot of things in learning by design that kind of look ingenious. They didn't come from genius, they came from a lot of really interesting observation. And what I thought people would be interested in is kind of how we got to where learning by design is and what can be learned from the effort. But I don't really know how much detail all of you want on that. So I have my slides, but I want you to ask questions. I want you to say, hey, wait a minute, you know, tell me how you got to that. That would be a really interesting story. So please do that. I will try to look and see that you have your hands up. If I don't, interrupt me. So really, I somehow like to make this interactive. So I'm moving to slide 2. And as I said, there are a lot of different things I could talk about. And I think, as I said, I want to say it a little bit differently. I feel like what I'm really good at is designing experiences for learners. So one of the things I can talk about is how to use what we know about learning to design ways of helping people learn. And I am going to start out by talking about that. I can, in addition, if you want me to, talk about the design of software that we've created to support, well, it was to support learning by design, but really to support any design-based, project-based, or problem-based inquiry learning. And we did turn learning by design, we did integrate learning by design with a bunch of other units to create a whole 3-year middle school science curriculum called Project-Based Inquiry Science, and I could say a few words about that. And I think that one of the really interesting things that we've learned along the way is that just because you design it so that it ought to do everything that you want it to do so everybody will learn, doesn't necessarily mean that teachers will use it the way you want, faculty will use it the way you want. It doesn't necessarily mean that the learners are actually going to act the way you want them to act, that they're going to participate the way you want, you think that they were going to participate. So so we've learned some things about how to make what you've designed work. Two things that I could talk about with respect to that, and that I think are really important things that came out of learning by design, are how do you ease learners into it? The article from the script book, that the chapter I should say from the scripts for CSCL book that Frank sent you, is really about that, easing learners into it. Then the other thing related to that, very highly related to that, is this idea of creating the culture in the learning environment. I was going to say in the classroom, because learning by design is in the classroom, but it doesn't matter if it's classroom or somewhere else. Creating that microculture so that learners actually participate the way that you imagine that they would participate. So so I don't know, does anybody want to say anything about any of that, and what in particular is would be interesting to you before I go on? Okay. Go.
Thank you. I am actually interested in all of that, and I'm specifically interested in the software, and also thinking about external scripts.
Okay. Oh.
Yeah, excuse me, Janet. Can you give me directions to where I can access the slides again, please?
The access to the slides is in the chat box. If you look in the chat box, hey, Frank and Daniel, aren't you proud of me? I've learned this. If you look in the chat box, you'll see some URLs.
Okay, thank you very much, Janet.
Okay, so so I want to start, I'm on slide 3. I want to start by just telling you about how we got to where we, to learning by design. So I was telling you that I started by having some feelings that the research I was doing on case-based reasoning could tell us some things about how to foster learning. And I also told you that my kids were coming home and telling me science was boring. So I think that we started out in 1994 by kind of being confused about why kids were finding science so boring, and also having the feeling that not only case-based reasoning, but also design could help ameliorate those problems. And when I say also design, I guess I should have said earlier that I've spent almost my whole career, except for the last 3.5 years that I've been at the National Science Foundation, I've spent my whole career at Georgia Tech. Georgia Tech is a technological university. It's mostly engineering. It's also got very good architecture. By the time I started working on this, we had a very good College of Computing. And a lot of faculty and a lot of activity at Georgia Tech revolves around design, doing design and analyzing designs. And I had the opportunity to sit around with a lot of very smart faculty at Georgia Tech. I was running a institute called EduTech. As we sat around the table and we started thinking about what we as Georgia Tech could do about they didn't call it STEM education then, but about science and math and education, people went around the table and they said, well, we know a lot about design. And somebody else said, in design, you could use that for science. And design, kids could get really excited about that. So that was basically what was happening in the environment around me. And because design, I mean, I assume everybody here is a designer in some way. I mean, you know that whenever you attempt to design something, it doesn't work the way that you assumed it would to begin with. Sometimes it's an outright failure, and sometimes you just see that it could do a lot better. And that was a really good match to what we were learning about learning from case-based reasoning. And I'll talk about case-based reasoning in a moment, so you don't need to know about case-based reasoning yet. But the issues at the time were that kids didn't see, there's still the issues now. Kids didn't see the relevance of the science that they were doing to their lives. Some of the science that we want people to learn is really quite difficult, and the kids could become, any learner can become easily disengaged, frustrated. Teachers, we found, and this was what I found when I looked into why my kids were not enjoying science, is the teachers in middle school and elementary school don't always know the science they're teaching, so it's really hard for them to make it engaging. And textbooks, well, they were really bad. I mean, they were always, well, they almost all do that now. They present science as facts, but not as something done by people. And so, again, the richness of science wasn't part of it, and we thought that that was one of the reasons that the kids were disengaging. So I'm on to the next slide. So we wanted to achieve some goals. We wanted to make sure kids were learning science better. So we wanted deep learning of science content for everybody, not just the good students. We realized at Georgia Tech that we were all those people who were at the top of our class. Anything that was done in science, you know, we participated, we learned it. So we wanted to make sure that everybody would learn. We wanted to make sure that that it wasn't just the students of teachers who understand the science who would learn, but students of any teachers. And we didn't want those who easily understood to become bored. So those were some things we put out on the table. Though nobody was talking the language of 21st century skills at that time, we did know that we wanted learners to not only learn science facts, but we wanted them to learn about how real people do science. And to tell you the truth, my idea at the time was that if you look at the I better not say this. Okay, so we wanted kids to learn. We wanted them to learn about how people make decisions. We wanted them to learn to collaborate. We wanted them to learn to work on projects together. And we wanted them to appreciate science's value and to come to just think scientifically at the times when they should be thinking scientifically. And of course, we wanted them to sustain long enough so that they would learn. Later on, once learning by design became successful, I had another goal that I wanted to cover 3 years of science learning in middle school, but science education in middle school, but that came later. So our answers. So what does learning by design do? So when kids are learning science in the context of achieving design challenges, okay, what happens is we're integrating for them the learning of content and the learning of reasoning. And we're doing that by having them learn the science in a context of authentic use. Okay, and you can ask me about that if you want to later on. We also thought that we should make the classroom a place. Well, our answer is that we've made the classroom a place, and learning by design does this. It makes the classroom a place for addressing challenges together. So solving problems and achieving design challenges and making sense of science together. And our answers also to how to make all those things happen were to make it interesting. Well, whatever that means, right? Choose challenges so that the particular learners who are going to be doing them would be excited about them. And then in addition, help them to become interested in each of the challenges, help them to get excited about it. So that's what we mean by make it interesting. And particularly we have learned how to design challenges so that opportunities for learning can kind of be grabbed, you know, taken from what the learners are doing and taken advantage of. So let me go on from there. So as I said earlier, and as Frank said earlier, I got my start in artificial intelligence, and in particular in case-based reasoning. So case-based reasoning is a way of having the computer solve problems based on its experiences. And it was inspired by people. So we do this all the time. We walk around the world, run around the world, you know, whatever we do. We're moving around in the world, and we have goals. And we are attempting to accomplish our goals, and we're creating new goals as we go along. And as we do that, we're learning, we're applying things we learned in old situations to new ones. So, you know, one of my favorite domains for looking at this is food, is cooking. So if I have this goal of creating a wonderful new recipe for butternut squash soup, I will remember some other ones that I made, and I'll remember how I made those. And I'll say, yeah, but that one wasn't sweet enough, and that one was too sweet. I'd really like actually to have a little bit more lemon flavor in it, maybe some curry. And I'll take my old recipe and I'll adapt it to my new goals, and I'll make it fit. So I'm applying the lessons learned in the old situation to the new one. If an old one was too salty, or too sweet, then I will use that failure in order to inform how to adapt something new that I'm doing to make it fit the new situation. So sometimes a case-based reasoner, sometimes we succeed in our endeavors, sometimes we fail. When we fail, we attempt to explain what was responsible for that failure. I made a pear fennel soup a couple weeks ago, and I didn't taste the pear, and I didn't taste the fennel, and I'm trying to explain why. And I think it's because I put in a stock, right? So I need to explain that, because that pear fennel soup really should have tasted very good, and it didn't. So I attempt to explain, and I might then, as I have done actually, decide not to use that brand of stock anymore when I'm making soups with subtle tasting ingredients in them. I had that discussion with my daughter-in-law yesterday. Okay, so when we fail, we attempt to explain what was responsible for the failure, and we add those new lessons to our memories. And how do we extend our knowledge? We extend our knowledge by adding new cases, by re-explaining or re-encoding, re-indexing old ones, by abstracting out generalizations, and basically indexing them, basically labeling them. I just said that next time I'm thinking about stock that I'll use for a new soup, I labeled that explanation that I just gave you about that stock not working, about wanting subtle flavors to come through. So if I'm making something later on where I want subtle flavors to come through, I'm gonna remember that case where I used the stock that had too much flavor in it, and I'm not gonna use that stock. So expectation failure, I didn't taste the pear, I didn't taste the fennel. Explanation, gosh, that stock must have come through too strong. Okay, and then I'm going to need to try it again, actually, to be able to debug that explanation that I just came up with. So that's case-based reasoning. And we thought that if I'm on slide 7 now, okay, so we thought that case-based reasoning provided suggestions about productive learning from experience. So case-based reasoners have personal goals, short-term goals and long-term ones. My short-term one in the future will be some particular soup that I want to make. In the long-term, I have this goal of being a good vegetarian cook, making good vegetarian soups. Case-based reasoners interpret their goals their experiences to shed light on how to achieve their goals. So they interpret the experiences they've had to shed light on how to achieve those goals. And learning happens in that process, in the process of achieving short-term goals and readying oneself for achieving long-term ones. So the idea was that we thought was that we could have children learn by helping them have personal goals related to the science and engineering we want them to learn. Okay, I have personal goals having to do with cooking. We can have kids have personal goals related to science. We could help children learn by helping them have experiences that can help them learn the content and practices for achieving their goals. Okay, so if we get them excited about designing a car that will go long and far and beat the cars of their other students in the class, okay, then they will want to have experiences that will help them learn about forces, learn about velocity, learn about friction, learn about going straight, right, how forces combine with each other, learn about going up hills, learn about the kinds of propulsion systems that will make that happen. They'll want to learn those things to achieve those goals. And of course, we need them to learn from those experiences and not just have those experiences. We need to help them interpret those experiences to get the most out of them. So that's very simply what learning by design is, where it came from, very, very simply. And I'm going to go on to the next slide. The thing in 1994 was that I knew absolutely nothing about classrooms. I knew the only thing I knew about kids was in middle schoolers was what I knew about my kids and their friends. The only thing I knew about teachers were my experience with teachers and my kids' experiences with teachers. So, I mean, I was coming from artificial intelligence. I got people on my team, a person on my team, who knew problem-based learning. That was Cindy Mello Silver. So she joined my team as a postdoc. And then I got somebody else on my team who you probably don't know, Wendy Neustetter, who knew sociocultural theory. I didn't. I knew we had to use the social environment to make to, but I didn't know anything about social environments. I thought that she could help us with that. And then I also had Hari Narayanan, who was coming from computer science, and he was somebody who I thought could help with designing software that would make all of this happen. Anyway, our idea, and I'm on slide 8, our idea was that we would engage learners in a sequence of design challenges, and we'd have them actually designing working devices so they could get real feedback from the things that they were designing. So if you're designing a toy car, you make it go, and you see how far it goes, and you see how far off track it goes, and you see when it gets stuck on something. We would help them take advantage of those affordances that design has to promote learning. So when their car doesn't go as far as they want, they would ask questions about that. Why isn't it going that far? And they'd want to learn about forces. Use the design challenge to promote interest in learning that science and the need. They'd have a real need to carry out investigations, to engineer their cars, to communicate and collaborate with each other. And as we knew from case-based reasoning, learning is iterative. You learn, you add a little bit at a time, okay? And we thought that design being iterative too would be a good way to do that. So learning by design is project-based, it's problem-based, it's inquiry-based. Middle schoolers, the kids work in groups on design challenges that require iteration, that require the targeted science, that require collaboration. I think I already said most of this. If you go down to where the short-term goals is, it situates learning the targeted science in the context where they're authentically needed. They have short-term goals. They're going to keep doing science this way all year so that they start to have long-term goals when they find that the ways that they're communicating with each other is valuable, they want to have those long-term goals of communicating better with each other. When they find that designing experiments allows them, you know, the right way and running them well allows them to learn things they wanted to learn, then they want to get better at doing that. So it helps them to have those long-term goals. The really neat thing that we figured out is that middle schoolers, that's sixth graders, seventh graders, eighth graders, 12 years old to 14 years old, they really like to show off. So we figured that if they made presentations to each other, we could get them to actually reflect on their experiences in ways that would allow them to learn to learn from those experiences and also have vicarious experiences. That is, experience the experiences of the other people in the class. So they had more than only their own experiences, they had other people's experiences to learn from too. So here's how it works in the LBD cycles. That's slide 10. They have a design challenge. I can't point, I'm sorry. I'm looking at the design redesign cycle on the left. They have a design challenge and they work together as a class on trying to understand it. That requires a need to know some things. And they, on a project board, record the things that they need to learn more about. Once they have those things recorded, they start working in small groups to learn those things. They design experiments. They may run models as simulations. They may do some reading. But they divide the work up that they need to do to investigate and explore. That's the left circle. And they work on learning the things that they need, that they've identified that they need to learn in order to achieve the challenge. They then move back. They have this need to do now. They move back to the design redesign part of it, plan their design based on what they've learned. They might identify a need to learn more. They record that. And they might or might not do it at that time. They at some point when the teacher feels like they've learned enough to actually be able to do good design, they plan their designs and they make a presentation to the class. So these presentations are a really important part of what learning happens in learning by design, as I said before. When they make that presentation to the class about how I'm going to do my design and talk about why they're going to do it the way they're going to do it. And the rest of the class has a chance to say, well, wait a minute, I think that's not going to work. Or I don't understand why you're going to do that. They go back and redo some planning, and then they construct and test, and they present to the class again and say, look, here's how it worked, and it didn't do what I wanted it to do, and I'm not really sure why. And the class helps them to, they do that in a gallery walk, which is up near the top, and the class helps them to identify why it's not working, something's not working the way they thought, and how it could work better. One of the things I didn't say is that when they're over in this investigate and explore cycle on the right, each group in the class is doing some exploration or doing some investigation or reading something, running an experiment, running a simulation, anything that we might call investigation. Okay, and again, there's a cycle there, and it's a similar cycle. They're designing their investigation, conducting it, analyzing their solutions, their results, and then presenting to the class there. And they're saying, look, here's what I wanted to find out. Here's how I went about doing that. Here's my data. Here's what I think we can learn from it. And they hold court. They present to the class, and other people in the class say things like, well, I don't know. I mean, you did that three times and two of them, look like the results are the same, but one of them is way off on the side there. Why is it different? And they're actually talking about outliers, and they're talking about trusting data, and they're talking about replicability, and they're talking about running procedures the same way every time. And there's a chance to discuss all of those things. So those are the teachers facilitating so that those things that I just talked about are happening, so that the kids are asking each other questions, so they're sending each other back to do experiments again. So they're learning better about what it means to manage variables well, so that when they're in this present and share the gallery walk, so they're coming up with explanations that use the science that they're learning, et cetera. Shall I walk you through the vehicles challenge, or do you feel like you read enough about that? Why don't you vote? Should I, yes or no, should I walk you through the vehicles challenge? I won't do it with slides, I will just talk you through. Do you want to vote on that? If you go down to vote at the bottom, you can do that. I got two yeses, three yeses, a no, and an I'm not sure. Oh, four yeses, two nos. Okay, I guess I'm going to walk you through very quickly. Okay, so in Vehicles in Motion, the kids are challenged to design a small vehicle. I don't have one in my hands. I'm sorry. It's like a small vehicle and its propulsion system. In the beginning, when we first did this, it was a balloon propulsion system or a falling weight propulsion system, or somebody gave me a frown. I don't know why. A frown because I don't have a car to show you. I'm sorry. They were designing a small vehicle and its propulsion system. The vehicle is about 8 inches long, 4 inches wide, maybe 3 inches wide, maybe 10 inches long, whatever. They need to make it go far. They need to make it go straight. The challenge is to make it go over a hill and as far as they can make it go, and they make it into a competition. They begin by playing with a bunch of small cars, toy cars, and trying to make them go over hills. And as they do that, that's part of understanding the challenge. And as they do that, they discover that some of the cars can go over hills well, some of them can't. Some of them have wind-up mechanisms, so some of them already have mechanisms that make them go over the hills. Some of them they have to push. And they start asking questions, and they get recorded on a board. They start asking questions, how can we make a car How can you give it force so it will go over the hill? What happens when they bump into each other? You know, so those are the kinds of questions they ask, and those are questions that have to do with the challenge. The teacher then says to them, they've recorded all those questions, and the teacher says to them, well, gee, you know, these questions are about making a car go long and straight. Why don't we work on that? And it turns out that the first, we call it learning set, or the first module in the unit is about making cars go long and straight. Now that happens to be about combining forces, and we have them build and then make and then refine a coaster car that goes down a ramp and as far as it can. And it turns out that if there's a lot of friction in the wheels, in the axles and the wheels, the mechanisms there, that it tends to go off to the side or it tends to stop short. And so they work on getting the friction out of it. So they're planning designs, they're refining designs as they go along. They're presenting to each other what they think they're going to do to make the car better. I'm going around the design redesign cycle here. They're constructing it, testing it, analyzing it and explaining it, and they have a need to learn as the need to know as they're analyzing and explaining. And in this particular learning set, they mostly read about forces, though there are other things that they do later on. And they help each other explain, and they finally get to a coaster car. Everybody gets to a coaster car that can go a long way. And they're working in small groups of four and building two coaster cars in each of those small groups. And now they've made them go long and far, and they go back to that project board, and they've got more questions on there. They may generate some additional questions. And the teacher says, okay, so you know how to make it go long and far, but you all seem really excited about it. And the kids are, they're really excited about, okay, now we've been using ramps, how do we really make it go? So let's try, the teacher says, so why doesn't everybody try making a balloon propulsion system, make it go as far as it can and over the hill, as long and far as it can, with that instead of the ramp? And they try to understand that. Now, the way they're understanding that part of the challenge is that the teacher gives them a bunch of already made balloon propulsion systems. And these balloon propulsion systems have several different kinds of balloons. I mean, they have a balloon that's glued to a straw. You blow up the balloon through the straw. You position the balloon car on the, actually, you can see a picture of it in slide 12 at the top. You can see a picture of a balloon car and a bunch of balloon cars. So the balloons are attached to straws. The kids blow up the balloons through the straws. They've got paper cups that are holding the balloons and straw, holding that onto the car. And when they're ready to let the car go, they let go of the straw and the balloon provides propulsion and it goes. Okay, so going back to that diagram in slide 10, what happens, or you can follow along in slide 11, either way, why don't we follow along in slide 11? What happens is that the teacher distributes these balloon propulsion systems. They're all different from each other. The different groups play with a set of them. They come back and they say, well, what, they generate questions. How's the straw make a difference? You know, it seems like the different kinds of balloons make them work differently. Some balloons are bigger than others. Some balloons seem to be more elastic than others. How's that make a difference? Some of the straws are narrow, some of the straws are wide. How's that make a difference? Some of the straws are long, some of them are short. How's that make a difference? They ask all those questions and they record those questions on that public whiteboard. Okay, then each small group is given one of those questions to answer. The questions, actually the teacher has helped them to make those questions be questions of the sort of, how does the size of the balloon affect how far the car will go? The width of the straw affect how far the car will go. And each group in the class then takes one of those questions and designs and runs an experiment to learn about the answer to that question. They design and run their experiments, present them to each other in a poster session. What happens in the poster session, a group gets up, they make their presentation, they hold court, the rest of the class can ask them questions. This is where, as I said, they're going to do five trials, okay, of each one of their variations, and they're going to get good data or not so good data out of it, right? And the other kids are going to start asking them questions about it. They're asked to come up with a rule of thumb after they run their experiments. So a rule of thumb might be to make the vehicle go far, use a bigger balloon is better than a smaller balloon. Okay, and they'll have data to show that indeed that is the case. And if they don't have data to show that, then the rest of the class will say to them, well, wait a minute, your data didn't show you that. The teacher then says to them, okay, you know, why do you think that's happening? And that's where they get into really discussing the forces again. So they've read about forces up till now, okay, and now they're going to try and use what they've read to try to explain their rules of thumb that they've come up with. And there's actually, it's not written down here, but there's actually a way of having that discussion that they have. After all the results are in, okay, they go back to their small groups, and after they trust each other's results, one of the things they might do is send the groups back to go and run experiments again because they don't trust the results. But after they trust the results, Everybody's posters that they made for that pinup poster session are put on the wall so they can see all the results. Okay, and they go into planning their very best balloon-powered vehicle. Okay, they work on a three-column chart. That first column has design decisions in it. Second column has the data that supports their design decision. And the third column has the science that supports their design decision. And they come back to a pinup session, and they present their design ideas and their reasons for them to their peers. Now, some of the kids in the class understand the science better than other kids in the class. And some of them understand the data that came from the previous experiments better than the others. And they show their ideas to each other, and they question each other, and they help each other out to come up with better designs. Okay, after that's done, they go back and they work in their small groups. They construct their vehicles, you know, with the right size balloons that they had planned and the right size straws that they had planned, and they blow them up exactly the way they had planned and whatever, and they test them. And then they come back together in a gallery walk, and they show the class what happened. And in fact, the balloon cars never work exactly the way they wanted. So they work with each other to figure out how to move forward. And again, here's a place where they discuss the science again, because they're discussing how forces combine with each other. And they may be finding other sources of other forces that may be combining and discussing that combination of forces. Again, that's Newton's second law. They do additional investigation, demonstrations, reading, discussion of content, and they iterate over those last three steps, both towards better understanding and towards better solutions. When they finish making their balloon cars go, they come back to that whiteboard, that public whiteboard. They talk about what they've learned, they put it up there, and they say, but, you know, this isn't the very best propulsion system we can make. I think, you know, we can make a better one. And the teacher takes them into, again, another part of the module where they're doing that. I'm not going to go through that. At the end, they bring it all together, and they pull it all together into a design of their hybrid car that uses a lot of different propulsion systems, and why they used each one and why they configure each one that way. And they have a gallery walks and iterate again there, and discuss, bring all the science together there. Okay, now if you move into slide 12 again, you see several different things there. You see the balloon cars. At the bottom you see a poster that somebody has done. Does the number of straws in a balloon affect the performance of the car? Really should be, how does the number of straws, but the teachers don't run things exactly the way that we thought, that we planned, it's a yes, no question in this case, and it turns out it works okay too. In the other four of the pictures you see there, you see the kids working on a parachute challenge, and you see them dropping the parachutes. You see the teacher demoing or showing things in a couple of them. You see that the kids are really quite active in what they're doing. So there are a number of things I want you to notice, and then I'm going to go a lot more quickly, and hopefully I'll get to some of the other things you're interested in. So I want you to notice there are a lot of different opportunities for sharing with the class. The other kids want, the kids want each other's results, and there are a lot of opportunities for doing that. They need each other's results. They want advice from others. They have the opportunity to get help. Once they see that those things are happening, they quickly take charge whenever they're up there giving presentations, and they set themselves to making presentations that get them the results that they want, and that give them the credibility that they want with the other kids. So there's a real trick there. That's one of the tricks to getting the kids to really reflect on what they're doing and to get to really want to learn the science. There's a lot of repetition. They're running experiments a lot. They're designing experiments a lot. They're running them a lot. They're presenting to their peers. They're designing a lot, and say several different times in that unit, and each time saying, look, here's the data that tells me why I should do it that way. The science, here's the science that tells me why I should do it that way. They have lots of opportunities to explain why is my car, why is that group's car not working the way we wanted it to, and how can we use the science to make it better. So they get to retry with better skills and better knowledge, lots of opportunities for repetition in there. Questions are raised before activities are engaged in. So there's always some activity, we call it a messing about activity, there's always some activity that they engage in that gets them to ask the questions we want them to ask. And in that way, that means they're always doing every investigation with a purpose, every reading that they do is with a purpose, every demo that they see is with a purpose, all the learning that they're doing is with a purpose. And they only read after they've experienced something. I really didn't say much about the reading, but they only read after they've experienced something. We make it happen in the form, I'm on slide 14, we make it happen in the form of conventions. So there's a PBL whiteboard. There are these three kinds of public presentations. When they're discussing those, they have ways of, there actually are these embedded formative assessments, which are kind of, they don't look like formative assessments to them, but they look like formative assessments to the teacher. They're creating these rules of thumb, and they're explaining these rules of thumb, and that scaffolds data interpretation and explanation creation. And then there's one more convention that to me is the most interesting one, is our launcher units that introduce the community practices and the norms that help them learn how to make those presentations, how to collaborate with each other, how to make a rule of thumb, how to participate in a gallery walk, whatever. And each one has purpose, sequencing, you know, place in the sequencing, ways of doing. I can talk about launcher units, or I can give you a chance to ask me a bunch of questions. Why don't you, I don't know how the voting works. Do you want me to, I'll tell you what, use emoticons, okay? Do you want me to have you ask a bunch of questions now? Give me a happy face or a sad face if you want to stop and ask questions. They're in vote at the bottom. Okay, I see enough happy faces that I'm going to let you queue up and I'm going to stop broadcasting.
Okay, hello. One of the questions I have would be that you showed a list of goals at the beginning, and I would be interested how you see it, how you perceive it, which of those goals were achieved, how far are we in those goals, how far do we still have to go on some of them, and I would be especially interested in the goal that you mentioned that we have to find a way to not only engage the already smart and interested students, but also all the other students, and I would be especially interested if that goal was met by your learning by design approach.
Why don't I listen to all the questions, three or four questions, and then I'll talk about all of them.
Yeah, I'm noticing a lot of similarities with the case-based research and the modeling-based instruction used in physics. My question is, I'm struggling to see how this would apply to the biology courses that I am teaching.
Okay, so I'm going to answer those questions. So let's go back. I covered up my, okay, there we go. I covered up my sticky. Let's go back to the slide that had the goals and the goals we wanted to achieve. Okay, how far have we gotten with them? Okay, and especially how do we engage everyone? So let me start with that deep learning of science content with everyone. A really interesting thing happens in the classroom, and you'll probably want me to go back and talk about launcher units after we discuss this. A real interesting thing happens in the classroom. The kids are interacting with each other. I said a whole lot more about the kids than I said about the teacher. So the teacher's making all these things happen. The teacher's is facilitating all of it, right? But the teacher's very rarely telling the kids anything. Sometimes there's place for that. Sometimes that needs to happen. But what happens is that the kids are working in small groups, and then they're presenting to the class. Their small groups are presenting to the class, so it's kind of working as a class. So there's this small group work, there's working as a class, and in the small groups, the kids who understand more or the kids are going to be doing a lot of explaining to the other kids in the group. And they're generally in any group, well, in any good group. You've got some kids who are going to be kind of more imaginative about about achieving the goals, and some kids who are going to understand the science better, some kids who are going to be better with their hands and really making things work. And they each have a role to play, or they each have several roles to play. They're going to be some good organizers in a group, and they each have roles to play. And so what the kids find very early is that because of the complexity of what they're doing, when they work in their small groups, in general, they need everybody to be able to do the very best they can. The same thing happens when they present to the class. Okay, they're presenting, remember, they were dividing up the experiments so that everybody was, each group in the class was learning different things that everybody needed to learn. Okay, and then they're basically teaching it to each other. Now, again, some of the kids can do that better than other kids. And they have these rules of thumb, and they're trying to put explanations to them using science. Some of the kids are better at that than other of the kids. And they will spend a lot of time, making sense together, explaining to each other, helping each other. I hope you're all familiar with cognitive apprenticeship, but it really works very much like a cognitive apprenticeship in that the teacher's starting out by modeling many of these things. And then some of the kids in the class are better at doing it than others, and they're modeling for the others, and they're bringing the other kids along. Now, the kids who have some more imaginative ideas and the kids who understand the science better, I'm not saying they're the same kids, but they have a chance to go back in their small groups and use those things that they know better or can do better than others to make suggestions and make the things that they're suggesting the center of the discussion in that small group, and later on, the center of the discussion in the whole class. So so the kids who are out ahead are going to be they can always be out ahead. They can always be designing based on the way that they're out ahead. There's always time for the kids who are, not as far ahead to be learning from that. Everybody has a chance. So that's the answer to how we engage everyone. And it's also an answer to the deep learning of science content for everyone. With all that repetition and all those different chances to explain, to put explanations to the way that things that the vehicles work, and it's not always vehicles, but the way that things work or the solutions that all the different groups have come up with, there's a lot of different chance to apply the science that they're learning, to ask questions about it if they don't understand, to explain to each other. With respect to the learning of and you asked how far have we gotten with each. I have to say that as in any class, there are going to be some kids who don't learn as much as you wish they would. Okay, and perhaps I should talk about the software, because the software was designed for that. Also, sometimes the teachers don't know the science as well as we'd like them to, and in those classes, nobody learns the science quite as well as you'd like them to, but they certainly learn it a lot better than they would have if they were, reading from a book and the teacher didn't understand it and they weren't having these discussions. In terms of learning of science skills and practices and the nature of science, they're living that. They're doing that. And there's time during each of the presentation sessions to talk about each of those skills and practices. So there's time to talk about how do you make your results replicable, right? There's time to talk about outliers. There's time to talk about explanation, what makes for a good explanation. So they're doing it and they're talking it and they're doing it again and they're experiencing it over and over and over again. They're collaborating with each other. There's time to talk about that too, if the teacher makes the time for it. So the deal is that to the extent that the teacher makes the time to talk about each of these things, there's time to do it. And it does not sacrifice the deep understanding of the content. It's just a beautiful system. I mean, I'm kind of in awe of it myself. The appreciation of science's value and the disposition to think scientifically. So I think that every student in the class, I don't have data for this, but I think that everyone in the class starts to value science. And you see that in the presentations that they're making. You see that in the way that they engage. When we do performance assessments and we compared the learning by design kids with the kids who were just doing inquiry science with the very best teachers, you saw the learning by design kids just get into the groups and start working really fast. They knew what to do. And they always, you know, they could tell us why they were doing it and why it was important. So we have evidence of that. The disposition to think scientifically, that one's really interesting. And that one took me off to my next research that I did after learning by design. So when I think about disposition to think scientifically, I think that, you know, you're reading something in the newspaper about climate change, okay? And you say, wait a minute, or you're reading something in the paper about somebody who's saying there's no such thing, or people aren't doing it. And you say, wait a minute, you know, what's the evidence for that? What do we know about the data? What do scientists agree with? What are scientists saying about that? That's thinking scientifically, right? I want to make sure that these things that I'm hearing in the news, that these things that are going on in the world around me, I want to make sure I understand them. I want to see what I agree with and don't agree with respect to that. I want to find that evidence. Or I'm trying to put lighting in my kitchen, right? Where should I put it? Actually, we have this issue right now in the hallway here. They just painted our hallway a really, really dark green, and there's no natural light, and there are 100-watt bulbs every now and then down the hallway. And so you guys know enough physics to know that the very dark green walls are absorbing all of the light, and so we have a very, very dark hallway now. Okay, if somebody had thought scientifically about that, okay, then they might or might not have known about absorption of light, okay? But they certainly would have said, wait a minute, maybe science has something to tell us about what's going wrong in this hallway. Maybe science has something to tell us that, you know, has something to tell us about how light we ought to make the walls. So some of the kids were doing those things. Some of the kids were just standing up really tall. You know, I'm sitting down, but I'm sitting tall. Okay, we're standing really tall when they made their presentations and using their hands the way we use our hands and kind of jumping up and down like I'm doing right now. And they would look at the work that other people were doing. They would look at what was happening around the world around them, and they'd, you know, really be thinking like scientists, like student scientists, novice scientists. And that was just, to me, the result I got, because I wasn't expecting that. And so part of what I decided to do later on was to, figure out, we got that by accident, figure out how do we actually make that happen on purpose. The sustained motivation to engage, we had to work pretty hard to figure out how to sustain the units over 8 weeks of time. And that coming back to the project board, the whiteboard, over and over and over again, asking more questions, figuring out, you know, what do I know and what do we still need to learn to achieve the challenge, recognizing how far we've come in achieving the challenge and, you know, getting excited about it again and, oh, there's more we have to do. That was what we had to put in place to have the sustained motivation to engage. So we worked very hard at that. With respect to biology, that's quite interesting because I also was quite lost and didn't know what to do about biology. We had one unit we worked on early on where we had the kids were learning about arthropods and about function and structure, and they were building little robots that could do things the way arthropods can. So arthropods are, some of them, there's some insects that are arthropods, a lot of shellfish are arthropods. They have grasping motions. They have these things they do with their bodies. I mean, there are all kinds of things in their structures. And we had kids designing robots that could do things the way arthropods could. So for example, a grasper that could get something off of a high shelf, or somebody designed something that was very much like a crab and it would clean the top of clean the leaves from a swimming pool. It went around and it could grasp them and pull them in, and it could also use that motion to move around the pool. So we did that, and there was so much time that went into the robot building that there really wasn't enough time that went into the science. So, you know, it didn't work as well as we wanted it to work. But later on, I've got that later on at the bottom of the slide 4, later on, when we had the goal of coverage over 3 years of middle school science, that does include life sciences, it does include biology. And we have a number of units that that are run very similarly to the way learning by design works. They're not building things, but every time that we've got there, that they're planning something and showing it to the class. And there's a lot of discussion around their plans. So for example, in one of our units, we have kids designing on paper. This is the launcher unit. We have kids designing on paper a habitat for a zoo animal that's designed such that the animal can either feed or communicate as it would in the wild, and the people at the zoo will be able to see that actually happening. So they don't actually build this thing, but they plan this thing and where the cameras will go in addition to the environment itself. And they do a lot of watching videos of animals doing certain things, interpreting those videos, sharing those interpretations, discussing the differences between what I saw, my observations, and my interpretations, my inferences, using that in order to learn. Looking at videos and interpreting them and, you know, making best guesses from what they see in order to come up with some hypotheses about how different animals feed and how different animals communicate. Then they read about it after they've seen it and discussed it. They go back to, you know, after the feeding module, they go back to, okay, what else do we need to know? And they go on to their communication module. We get them excited about doing this thing and, you know, about learning how to learn what animals do, because that's really what we want them to be excited about for this unit, learning how to do the things that animals do. And we do it by having them observe three of their classmates a snack together. And every small group comes up with different interpretations of what's going on, and they start wondering about how can different groups, it's so simple, how can different groups be coming up with seeing different things, interpreting them in different ways, we need to come up with some standard ways to do that if we're going to do this well. And they come up with standard ways, and they watch their classmates again, etc. And they start getting very excited about the mystery in all of it. These are middle schoolers. So that's one of our units. Another of our units is about germs. It's about germs. It's about bacteria and viruses. It's also about body systems. And it's called Good Friends and Germs. And what they are challenged to do is to teach their school about good habits for helping each other stay healthy. And in the end, they make posters that they put up in the lunchroom, that they put up near the bathrooms, that they put up near the water fountains. And there are enough of those places around the school that even if you have, you know, six middle school classes, you get enough places for them actually to display it. And they ask a lot of questions about sickness. They ask a lot of questions about how people get sick, about what are the organisms that make them sick. They don't use the word organism, but eventually they start doing that. They get interested in learning about different epidemics along the way. By the way, we also introduce them to the people, to the scientists who found out about all those things, who made the discoveries and how they did it. In another unit, what's another one of our biology units? Oh, in another unit, they're designing a new breed of rice that will grow in newer climate conditions where there's less water available, and that will actually be more nutritious because people are more and more eating their rice white and not eating it, even in developing countries, and not eating it brown the way that they used to. So they learn genetics through that. They learn about adaptation, all kinds of things. They learn about predators and prey somewhere along the way. I can't remember where. They learn about monocultures, and they learn about, I already said evolution. So they learn about Mendel's experiments. I mean, there are all kinds of things they learn there. So they don't actually build things that they get to try out and see how it works, but they try things out, present them to the class, and the class asks them a lot of questions.
Sorry to interrupt. There are a couple of questions. First, I think Buffalo, if you allow, Janet.
Janet, I have a question. You mentioned that there was a software involved in learning by design. Can you talk a little bit about the role of the software, how essential the software is for the learning by design? Thank you.
Okay, Antoine, another question, but I just wanted to remind us all that we have about 10 minutes left or so. I wanted to ask the question to you, Janet. What do you think are important open questions with respect to learning by design? I wondered, for example, not sure if you see that alike, what is the role of the teacher? So if you have teachers and you look at the level of scientific reasoning that some teachers show, the question is, can we be satisfied with that? And what that has as consequences for teacher education? So this is more in the direction of practice, but also that could come with a couple of open research questions. So how to best qualify the future teachers to design-based learning lessons.
Okay, so I didn't realize there wasn't any time left, but I want to point you to, I'm sorry, I'm gonna point you to slide. I did this for me, and now I'm not finding it. I'm gonna point you to slide 60. Will you go to slide 60? And I think that, you know, challenges for the future to answer both questions at the same time. It works in the aggregate, but I think that there are some issues of addressing individuals better. And I think you don't want to, I wouldn't want anybody to go so far as to address individuals that you don't have all this group things happening that are so powerful. But that's basically where we came up with the, I'm on 62 now, where we came up with the roles for the computer. So new roles for computing. Can we use the computer to help kids interact in their small groups when the teacher is not available to facilitate? And again, that gets into some of the teacher education things. I think that the teacher education is a huge open question. How, you know, if you're going to do these things massively, I mean, a lot of people are going to do it. How do you help the teachers learn to do it? And I have to say that I don't have an answer for that yet. My publisher, you know, I'm getting royalties from project-based inquiry science, but I don't know exactly how the teachers are learning, and I think it's not done well. But I think this is one of those places where you can have software and the teacher divide up that work. And then the other thing is that somebody asked the biology question. When you can't get real feedback from the world, or when real feedback takes a long time to get, then I think that part of the answer is that you use software to help. So we asked the question, what would it take for computer modeling and simulation systems to help with those, you know, the limitations posed by time? And so those were some things that we've done with technology. I don't have time to go through this, but if you look at the the slides and the you'll see pictures of what we've done with the technology to do that. So I'm just going to point you to that. I think that another open question. I think that with learning by design, we created something for middle school. So it takes advantage of who middle schoolers are to make everything work. So there are a number of principles that are important to making it work. And what I was going to do, but of course I didn't get there. What I was going to do is have you look at how do you repeat that kind of success. And if you look at slides 22 through about 30, you find answers there that I took from a lot of different talks I've given in the past 10 years. And there's some cognitive explanations, there's some sociocognitive explanations, there's some combination of cognitive and culture answers to the explanations. And I think that it's that what has to happen now, and I know that some of you are quite interested in this, is taking those explanations, you know, the best of those explanations, and using them to go beyond middle school, right? To say, how can we do this in biology? What are the important things we want to do? Or I want to do it in high school physics, and there's just, you know, there's so much that has to be covered that there's no time for this or that. Or by high school, kids don't want to show off so much. Or in the college classroom, we're only in the classroom, you know, 3 hours a week or whatever it is. So the explanations, you know, for what makes it work, you know, are there to help you understand what are the really important aspects you have to have in it, and how do we make it work for beyond middle school. And I guess I would say that I haven't taught now for like 5 years, but I would say that in my classes, my introduction to the learning sciences, my introduction to designing learning technologies, I would say that I pretty much use a a learning by design approach in there. I have people working on projects. I have them reporting back a lot to the class, but I do it quite differently. I do try to take those explanations into account. I did not talk about creating culture, and I think that creating the culture to make it work is a really important thing. And I think, again, that going back and looking at what is in here about the launcher units, and really what's in that chapter in Frank's book, the chapter about scripts, I mean, I think that that has a lot to say about creating culture. And again, I can tell you how to do it in middle school classrooms, but I can't tell you a lot about how to do it I can't tell you specifically how to do it in other situations. The specifics of doing that have to be worked out, and there could be a whole lot more that we learn about creating culture in doing that. And the last open question that I guess I want to talk about is that disposition and identity question, issue. We want kids to think about themselves as scientific reasoners, or you might want kids to think about themselves as mathematizers. Or you might want students to go into biology, or if you're teaching general science classes, as some of you have said, civic science literacy, okay? You want them to have that disposition to go out and think scientifically. You want them to have identities as scientific reasoners. You want them to go out there in the world and say, yeah, I'm not afraid of the science. You know, I know how scientists do it, and I can begin to do this stuff. So I think that really that we create, you know, learning by design is a system that helps to create disposition, but there's still an identity as a scientific reasoner, but there's still a way to go in knowing how to do that, you know, knowing how to design for that. David.
So one question that I have is there any recent research on the cognitive processes involved in design thinking? I think about Carl Breiter's discussion about design mode and belief mode work, and they seem to correspond to certain processes, and I wonder if you can point me to recent research on that.
I might have to get back to you on that because I haven't been living in that world for a while. If I were out there doing research on a regular basis, I would be able to do it. But I'm gonna have to point you to that later on.
Well, I have one question that we ask our guests or our presenters that I wanted to ask you as well. And especially ask you, what would be your recommendations for PhD students in the learning sciences? So how should they, maybe you have a general hint, but I think an important questions are, of course, how could they somehow employ learning by design, but also what would be your recommendation, how they can use technologies in their work, given the fact that technologies are evolving so quickly. So maybe you have some couple of recommendations or reflections on PhD studies in the learning sciences.
So actually, Frank, I'm really glad you asked the question about using technology and technology evolving so quickly. So I think that in the learning sciences, I think that we have, you know, some of us have shorter term goals and some of us have longer term goals. So some of us want to make things happen in classrooms or wherever else right now, and some of us want to aim towards the future. I think that it's, with respect to technology, it's probably a bad idea to just be designing technology, you know, designing applications for particular purposes. I think that the important thing in designing applications and designing technology is to be pulling out from those designs, from those studies with those designs, the things that the people who are building the next one with the next technology will be able to use. So I've talked to you, just like I've talked to you a lot about how important all of those presentations that the kids do are. Okay, if all I did was tell you, look, here's how learning by design works, okay, I wouldn't be able to answer any questions about biology, right? I wouldn't be able to say anything about civic science learning. But there are lessons from learning by design that that have to do with creating the culture where you can have the discussions you want to have, with sharing responsibilities around the classroom, with making presentations and having the kids have some control. There are lessons about those things that come from learning by design. And I think that it's got to be the same thing with technology. When you're building that that piece of technology for helping people learn about evolution, right, you want to be also thinking about, you know, what are the functions the technology needs to have for that? Not just what is it doing, but what are more general purpose functions it needs to have? What are the kinds of moving around in the system that you want to allow people to do? What are the lessons that can be learned about learning about other complex systems, about change over time, about emergence, thinking about not just designing that thing and building that thing for people to learn about evolution, but thinking about building that thing for evolution in order to learn about how you help people learn about emergent properties, to learn about how you help people learn about change over long periods of time, to learn about how you help people learn about complex systems, to learn about how to help people not get lost, right, in a complex complex simulation and modeling environment. So I think that that's the really important thing. I think with respect to employing LBD, I mean, I think that it's got a lot of lessons in it, and I didn't get a chance to say a lot of them. But there are a lot of them in the slides. And they're more in the papers that you read. But I think that the really important thing there is using those lessons. You know, how can those lessons, what's the more general form of those lessons? You know, try it out over other populations. Try it out over other disciplines. Try it out over other venues. I mean, we were trying it out in after school venues where you just can't have the kids, you know, you can't make them do things for grades, okay? It makes it a little harder. So I think that that's important. And I guess that my recommendation for PhD students, my recommendation for everybody is that there are some things that it's easy to investigate and there are things that it's important to investigate. And I think it's really important, I mean, I want to urge you not to confuse those two things, that some things are hard to investigate and you can only make a little bit of progress. And science advances by making small amounts of progress and adding to that and adding to that and adding to that. And so if what you're doing is want to do is really important and you can only make a little bit of progress, and it's not time to do experimental work yet, then do that observational work that helps you come up with some, you know, with some candidate explanations that you'll do other investigations on later on. But don't feel like you have to do a certain kind of research. Or you know, a certain thing that can get done.
Thanks a lot, Janet. These were great recommendations. I also wanted to thank you for that great talk and for the discussion with us. I learned a lot, and I think one thing that you especially pointed me to today was that combination of repetition and refinement that also connects learning by design to case-based reasoning. I think that was a part of the jigsaw of the puzzle that I haven't had so clearly in mind before that session. And I also liked your shaped a couple of open questions so going beyond middle school, try out learning by design in different new fields. And I think that's an interesting and huge challenge for the whole field of the learning sciences. I would like to thank you very much for that. Maybe we could have a very quick round of saying bye-bye and maybe commenting on something, and then you might have the final words, Janet, and then I think we should close the session.
Yeah, I would love to hear what other people have learned. I don't want to put you on the spot.
Well, hi, Janet. Thank you very much for addressing my question about the biological sciences. You actually did get me thinking of some ways when you started talking about science practices. And I think that as long as I keep that as the focus, the science practice, I can make this work in my undergraduate biology courses. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much for today's very interesting webinar. For me, myself, it was highly relevant for my PhD project, which is about scientific reasoning and mathematics and intervention possibilities. And I think it was very interesting for the others too, and we would like to say thank you. Bye-bye.
Hi, Janet. Thank you so much for the insightful workshop. I'm new to learning sciences. I did not read your recommended readings before I came, so initially I thought this session was about design-based research. So now I understand learning by design and design-based research are totally different topics. So I thank you for helping me to understand.
Using design in learning, I think, is a very important subject. And I just really appreciate listening to your stories and the way that you described using it in the classroom and just your experiences as a researcher and as a designer of projects. And that helps me think about what I hope to be doing with my PhD studies and beyond. So thank you.
Hi, Janet. Thank you very much for your sharing. It's been fantastic. I think it's helped me clarify some ideas as well. And yeah, thank you.
Okay, Janet, final words.
So yeah, let me just say something about learning by design and design-based research. We would not have gotten to where we did with learning by design with respect to its design and also with respect to the things that can be learned from it without the design-based research. So, I mean, that was our way of doing research. I didn't tell you about all the iterations and, you know, the things that didn't go exactly right in the beginning. And I think that our biggest secret weapon, in fact, in doing the design-based research and making it work well was the observation that we did. We did very, very careful observations. And it wasn't only observations of things that were going wrong that we wanted to fix, but all kinds of things that were happening that we didn't expect. And it was those things that were happening that we didn't expect that in fact were quite, just had all kinds of great affordances that led to some of the things in learning by design that seemed very ingenious. So I'm happy to talk individually with some of you if you want. The other thing that I wanted to say in response to what somebody said, I can't remember who it was now, about using design and learning, is that we started with learning by design, but what I learned was that it's, you know, it expands beyond design. We were able to do it in putting a whole 3-year middle school science curriculum together. And again, I can point you to some readings about this, to a reading about this if you want, but we were able to do it beyond design. And I think that idea of focusing on the practices, I mean, I think that's really very much a key. You focus on the practice and there are all kinds of other things that can happen if you're doing it semi-authentically, you know, the way that actual practitioners would be doing it in the world. then you're going to get to the science, you're going to get to the math, you're going to get whatever it is, the content and the practices as you're doing it. So I thank you very much for being an audience for me. And I'm sorry I talked so much and that I didn't actually have more time for you asking questions. And maybe if you want to invite me back, I'll try not to bore you next year.
Sorry, I would just would like to say, well, Deal, you are cordially invited to come back, and we continue the discussion at a later point in time. Again, thank you and bye-bye.